Session number 11515, Edward Tappenden, Real 1.
Can you tell me about what unit you were in when you undertook the Pegasus Bridge operation?
I was in D Company, 2nd Battalion, Ox and Bucks Light Infantry, which was airborne, and we were attached to the 6th Air Landing Brigade.
Do you remember which company, which platoon you belonged to?
I wasn't in a platoon, I was a company headquarters.
Why was that?
I was quartermaster clerk when I joined the company, and then I became Major Howard's personal wireless operator, and I was in charge of all the company wireless operators, which was 6 of us. And I had to train them for the D-Day. We used to go out into the field and send false messages just to get practice and practice for when D-Day came.
Who were the NCOs in charge in D Company?
We had Sergeant Major Flexen, Quartermaster Sergeant Smith, and we had Sergeant Barwick, Sergeant Godbold, can't think of the other two names. Sergeant Jarvis, I think, was the other one.
Can you take me through the preparations and training that you did for the Pegasus Bridge operation in detail, as far as you remember it?
As far as I can remember, my job was to train the wireless operators for each platoon. Each wireless operator had a certain code. It was Abel Baker, Easy Fox. And we had four code words. The officers was always Sunray 4. John Howard was Sunray. And that was the messages we used to send so that the chaps knew. And every day, every afternoon, I used to leave the office work, and we used to go down into the fields behind what we called the spider block where we were billeted. And we used to send these messages to each other and trained until D-Day came.
Where was the spider block? What village was this?
It was in Bulford Camp. There was a big camp, but D Company was in the spider block. And that's where we stayed all the time for about 3-4 years in Bulford.
What kind of range did this equipment have?
Well, 38 set had a range of about three miles. 3 miles would have been the limit. That was the reason why I stayed on the bridge by the gun pit all night, because I had 3 platoons at the river bridge and 3 platoons over in Benneville Village over the other side of the bridge, and to keep in contact with them I had to be in more or less the centre of them. So the major decided to have the command post near the pillbox where we knocked out the German gun crew.
Was this equipment heavy?
No. We had microphones on our throat, a very small arrangement, microphones on our throat, and earphones, so that we could send. We didn't have to speak into a microphone. It was attached to our throats, and we used to speak through the vocal cords.
And the batteries weren't heavy?
No. You could carry them all day, and they weren't like the 18 set, which was a big set that somebody had to carry on their back, and two had to operate it. One carried it and the other one operated it. But I could run and do anything with a 38 set. Biggest problem was the 6-foot aerial that you had. You had 6-foot aerial, and that was the biggest problem.
Because it was getting in the way.
It was swaying around quite a bit, but there was no problem after a certain amount of training with them, but I was in charge of the wireless operators for the operation.
Did the aerial telescope?
No, it was in sections. It was in sections. You built it up. I think it was about three sections, which gave you a 6-foot aerial. But they were very... I've never seen one since I left the army. But they were really good sets. I had no problem, except when we captured the bridge and I was trying to contact the paras that landed in Romville, and I never got an answer. But I understand that the equipment was all lost in the drop, so they never got the message, Ham and Jam.
In the training, did you have to do the infantry training like the others?
Oh yes. I did all the route marches and all the night training, and because where the major went, I went. I mean, he used to say I was his shadow. And if I wasn't there, he used to have a saying, blast your ruddy eyes, because if I wasn't there, I was with the major. Everywhere the major went, I was right behind him all the time, even in Normandy.
Because he was so dependent on you.
Well, you see, he couldn't control the company without the wireless, with the communications between the platoons and the company commander.
So would you have had to substitute as a soldier if necessary?
Oh, yes. I did everything. If I hadn't got the wireless, I could have done anything that the... I mean, all the German weapons. I went on training to learn how to use German weapons. I went on map training. I went on route marches. I was on the big march from Ilfracombe, when we marched 143 miles in 4.5 days back to Bulford, and we were the only company that completed the march with a full company. We had two men finish the day's marching, and the medical officer put them sick, so we were still a full company. And we marched into Bulford at regimental pace after doing 143 miles, 4.5 days foot slogging. And I, same as the major, I slogged all the way.
Were there any other tough things that you had to do in the training that you remember?
Not tough things. We used to do cross-country running once every Wednesday. Major used to take the company out for cross-country because he was a cross-country fanatic. And we used to go out... cross-country running, and nobody was allowed in front of the major until we approached Bulford camp, and then he would say, "Where you go?" And you just went by him like that. But I always stayed with the major. Wherever the major went, I was. Even on exercises, we used to go out on exercises. When we went to Exeter for the training for the bridges, I was always with the major.
What was Major Howard like as a leader?
Major Howard was the finest company commander I'd ever served under. His men came first, and the main point with the major was he wouldn't ask any soldier to do anything he couldn't do himself. He marched the 143 miles back from Ilfracombe, and I even offered him the push bike that somebody gave me to... to push, and he said, "No, I'm not want that ruddy thing." He said, he marched the whole way up and down the column all the time.
Do you remember the briefing that you got about the tasks which the unit would have to carry out in the capture of the bridges?
Yes, they were very vague at first, because the major was under secrecy orders that not to divulge where it was or anything. And it wasn't until we were at the transit camp that we saw a model of the bridge that we were going to capture, and also the river bridge.
Where was the transit camp?
That was near Tarrant Ruston, where the aerodrome was. Wasn't far from there. Always remember our padre at the camp. He was a Scottish padre. And just before, because you know it was cancelled for 24 hours, and then we had the all clear to go. And I always remember the padre walking into the centre of the compound with a cross. He stuck it in the ground. And he said, "We don't need a church, lads. Come here and pray." And everybody, even the Naffy girls that were there, they was all round the padre. He was a great chap, great chap. And you could argue and swear and anything to him. And no offence, he was great.
What was his name?
I think it was Harvey. I'm not sure of his name there. So long ago. And but we had all the different briefings and all the different codes, and then near the day, B Company, two platoons of B Company, came and joined us. So I had six wireless operators. I had Abel, Baker, Charlie, Dog, Easy, Fox. They were the six code words. And ironically, the last code word, Fox, was the name of the platoon commander, Lieutenant Fox. So it was a bit confusing, that. But no problems. We had no problems.
Had you been in action before?
No. No.
How did you feel about going into action?
Scared, I suppose. I think everybody was scared. And, I mean, when the gliders hit the ground at approximately 120 miles an hour, and you link arms, you lift your feet, and you lose the wheels, and then you've got to come in on the skid, which was, I think, was a marvellous operation. And it has been said by senior officers of the Royal Air Force that it was the most marvellous flying that Jim Woolworth had ever done. Because at the briefing, John Howard, I think he said it as a joke, we knew that it was barbed wire all round the bridge. And he said to Jim Woolworth at the briefing, "I want you to put the nose of the glider into the barbed wire." And Jim didn't take very kindly to it, but he put the nose of the glider in the barbed wire.
Why wasn't he keen on doing it?
Well, because it was more or less impossible. He thought at the time it was impossible to put the glider.
To be so precise?
Yeah. I mean, because you've got no engines or anything. But it was a marvellous piece of flying. I mean, when you fly a glider, you see, we left England, came across the Channel at about 7,000 feet, came in over Cobourg, which is about 10 kilometres, I think, from the bridges. And then you're released by the bombers, and you do it by stopwatch and compass. And you go so many seconds, and then you change course. And he finished up coming in from the Caen area. And just as we got to just before we landed, there was a break in the clouds, and the moon showed the canal and the river. And he knew he was exactly on course. And he hit the ground at 120 miles an hour and bounced. We lost the wheels, which we knew would happen, and bounced up into the air. And he released the parachute in the tail of the glider, which had never been operated before. It was the first time. And that sort pulled us back. And then we hit the ground again about 60 mile an hour and glided in with sparks flying everywhere. We thought it was bullets or what they call them. I can't think of the word now.
Flares?
Yes, flares that was coming from the Germans, but it was the sparks from the skid hitting the stones in the fields as we went along. And he put the nose of the glider right into the barbed wire.
When you embarked in the glider, were you equipped the same way as the rest of them, except for the wireless equipment?
I had a revolver. I was equipped as exactly the same, but all I carried was a revolver. I didn't, because I was at the operation of the set, switching it on and off and all this sort of thing. So I didn't carry any rifle or Sten gun or anything like that. I knew how to use a rifle and a Sten gun, but I was carrying a revolver.
What kind of revolver?
Oh, I forget.
Can you describe the embarkation, what it was like?
The embarkation was very smooth. We left the... We had the all clear to go, and we went to Tarrant Rushton, and when we arrived, there were six Lancaster bombers with six gliders in tow. And the first three gliders were to attack the bridge and the Clown Canal, and the other three were to attack the river bridge. The River...
Horn?
Horn. Yes, the River Horn, that's right. But, as it happened, one glider went astray. So there was only two gliders attacked the River Horn, and the three gliders attacked the Pegasus, what was now known as Pegasus Bridge.
How were you sat in the glider?
Sit down the sides, facing each other. The major sat just behind the pilots. I sat next to the major, and then the sections went down. And opposite the major, near the door, was Lieutenant Brotheridge. And his first section, I know there was Corporal Bailey, that job was to knock out the pillbox with Mr. Brotheridge. And then he went down to the tail. But there was always a story in the glider. Major Howard was always sick when he went flying. And every time we went flying, somebody would shout out with a comment, "Has the Major laid his kit yet?" And on D-Day, he wasn't sick. I suppose he was so worked up through, you know, that the operation was eventually taking place that he forgot to be sick. But he was a fine company commander.
So has the Major laid his kit meant, has he been sick?
He wasn't sick on D-Day.
But that was the meaning of the...
That was the meaning of the word, as a Major laid his kit, has the Major been sick, yeah. And
what was the atmosphere like in the glider as you took off?
It was very good. They were singing all the old London songs, because most of the lads were Cockney boys and Londoners, you know. And they were singing A.B., A.B. My Boy and all sorts of things until we got over France, and then the Major ordered quiet and everything went quiet and everybody was on their toes waiting to do their job. But
did he say stop singing or the Germans will hear you?
No, quiet, just quiet lads, and that was it, because John Howard had... He was the authority of D Company. There was nobody like John Howard, as far as I was concerned, as a company commander. His men always came first, and they always respected him.
How long would the crossing have taken, do you think?
Well, there's a little bit of controversy between different people of what time we took off, but I can tell you the exact time we took off, because my wife gave me a pocket Bible. I'm not religious, but my wife gave me a pocket Bible. And as we went down the runway, I wrote in the front of the Bible, left England for France, D-Day 11:25, D minus one. And I've still got it. I wrote that in there 40-odd years ago. I'll show you when we finished. But that was the time we left England. And as we climbed to about 7,000 feet, There was a break in the sky, and you could see the fleet lining up in the channel, and it looked as though you could step from ship to ship to for certain. Then we was away from it all, or going into it all.
Would it have taken more than an hour?
Well, I think it was at 11:35 we left England, and we arrived and we landed in France at 12:16, around about that time, about an hour, just less, short of an hour, and about 12:16 I think it was, we landed in France, and by 12:30 we captured the bridge.
So when you were released, you all stopped singing and you were just gliding in?
Yeah, we stopped singing before, when the bomber released us, the pilot told the major that we was being released, and quiet lads, and everything went quiet. Then we knew that we was on our own.
What did it feel like then?
No, we'd done it so often, you see. I mean, we spent a week at Bryce Norton doing what they called live loads for the pilots, and they was going up and down, and some of the lads were sitting in gliders from early morning to late in the afternoon, not getting out of the gliders. They was going up, coming down, going up. I had office work to do because I used to have to make sure the chaps got their pay and their maternity benefit and their soap coupons and all this sort of thing. And so I didn't do so many, but I did quite a number of flights, different flights. I took the first Jeep up for a demonstration at for General Gale at Gatwick, I think it was. We finished up. And I did my full share of flights.
Tell me about the landing, please.
The landing, once we got on course, as I say, we came in at about 120 miles an hour, hit the ground and lost the wheels, and we bounced back up into the sky, and we had a parachute in the tail of the glider, which the pilot gave the orders to be released. As soon as the parachute opened, it checked the speed of the glider and took us up again. And then we came down and we knew that we was on the skid. So it was locked arms and feet up off the floor, because that is normally the first part that goes, the floor. And we came in, and just before we stopped, Brotheridge released, opened the door, ready for the lads to get out. I think Danny Brotheridge was the first, Major Howard was the second, and I think I followed them. And then the section came out that was to deal with the pillbox. And they went across and dealt with the pillbox, and the command post for the company was near the pillbox. I laid on the road all night with Major Howard, sending messages and receiving, waiting for the position that the REs, the Royal Engineers, that's right, yeah, the Royal Engineers came out of the gliders and inspected the bridges, inspected the bridge and said that it was wired, but there was no explosives on the bridge. And as soon as their job was done, they formed a sort of platoon, a rifle platoon, on the side of the road. But and then I got the message from, I think it was 25 platoon, that it was ham. And soon afterwards, just round about 12:30, I had the message jam, so I reported to the Major, ham and jam. We captured the bridges and the bridge.
Can you explain what the two words ham and jam meant?
That was the code words for the capture of the bridge, of the canal bridge and the river bridge. Ham was the canal bridge and jam was the river bridge. And as soon as we got it, my job was to try and contact the paratroopers. That it was ham and jam. And I laid on the road for a solid half an hour, and that's all I was repeating. Ham and jam. In the end, I got so fed up with it, I said, ham and bloody jam, why the hell don't you answer? But I didn't get an answer.
Why didn't you get an answer?
I heard later, years later, that all the equipment had been lost, and the brigadier poet didn't receive it. And as I laid on the road, I saw three figures coming down the road, one leading, two, and one on each side of him, and halted him, gave the password, and when he approached, it was Brigadier Poet. And that was our reinforcements, one brigadier and two paratroopers. That was all the reinforcements we got for a long time, until the 7th came. And then Major Howard told me to send and tell Fox Platoon to come down and reinforce Benneville Crossroads. And Sergeant Saltman and Lieutenant Fox brought the platoon down. They went across the bridge, went up to the crossroads, and soon afterwards we had a message to say that they could hear tanks in the distance. That was reported back to us. And we heard no more for a time, when suddenly there was a terrific explosion, and there was shell bursting everywhere. And it was Sergeant Thornton had knocked out the first German tank that had come from Wistrom. And the other tank that was with it, there was Mark IV tanks. The other tank that came with it turned tail and went back to, as far as we know, to Wistrom.
Were you surprised at the relative ease with which the bridge was captured?
Yes, I suppose we were, really, because we landed about 16 minutes past midnight, and just after half past midnight, the bridge was, they were both captured. And only there was no opposition at the river bridge, none at all. I think the German sentries there just ran away. As far as I know, they just ran away, and Lieutenant Fox's platoon captured the bridge with Sergeant Saltman. But there was more opposition on the canal bridge, because that's where the garrison was more or less stationed. We'd lost. Lieutenant Brothers was shot through the throat on the other side of the canal bridge, and he died shortly afterwards. Sandy Smith, he was badly wounded in the arm. He thought he'd lost his arm at Benneville, so we had more casualties at Benneville, at Benneville village, than they had up on the other bridge.
Can you take me through in detail what happened to you next?